Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 59, Working with the Victims of Torture, November 7, 2006. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
People are very depressed. They can't sleep. They have nightmares. They are hypervigilant. You know, people are simply afraid. There's a persistent fear that they experience. And if you think about it, really, what torture is about instilling fear, and it's usually successful. Torture really is a political instrument. It's an instrument of oppression, and what it's designed to do is to shut people up, to have them get in line, to lie low, to flee the country, to no longer be a problem to those who are in power.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Uwe Jacobs, who is a psychologist and director of Survivors International, a nonprofit organization located in San Francisco, dedicated to providing essential psychological and medical services to survivors of torture who fled from around the world to the San Francisco Bay Area. Survivors International aims to help survivors put the pieces back together by providing the support they need to reestablish healthy and productive lives after their experiences of torture. Since 1990, Survivors International has provided treatment to over 2,000 survivors from 96 countries, treating an average of 25 to 35 patients a week through a growing network of providers, which include physicians, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and volunteers. Now let's get on to the interview. Dr. Uwe Jacobs, thank you for agreeing to be my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, you're welcome.
And you're currently the director of Survivors International. What is Survivors International?
Well, Survivors International is a nonprofit organization, non-governmental organization, that is dedicated to the care of survivors of torture and gender-based persecution. And we do direct service, information and referral, and advocacy for people who have survived torture and gender-based violence from around the world.
Mm-hmm. From around the world.
Yes.
When was the organization founded?
Well, it all started in about 1986, 20 years ago, and there was a group of clinicians in the East Bay primarily, and around a man by the name of Jerry Gray, and they were interested in this issue and wanted to create just such an organization to help survivors of torture. And it took a few years to really get it going, and then the first clients came, and it started sort of slowly to gain momentum, and then increasing numbers of survivors came for help. And at this point this year, we have just passed the threshold of 2,000 clients. So we have at this point seen 2,000 clients from 96 different countries.
Wow. And how did you get involved? When and how did you come on board?
Well, I got involved in, I think, 1994 it was, and simply because I was at the time in an internship, and I was supervised by Dr. Laura Dansky, and she was the clinical director at the time. And so she knew my work, and we got along well, and she asked me whether I had an interest in this, and I said, yes, of course. You know, it struck me as, you know, really a great thing, and I had been, you know, an Amnesty member as a young adult, like a lot of other people, mm-hmm. and for human rights and so on, and mm-hmm. And I had no idea really what this would mean. You know, what does it mean to encounter somebody who survived torture, and how or why could I help them, and so
right.
on. But I, you know, at that point in time, I was referred my first client, and that was actually, I just looked it up because we had this, you know, anniversary, as it were, you know, about the client number 2000. And the person that I saw was client number 300, and, you know, for the organization, mm-hmm. and which gave me an appreciation just of, you know, how much has happened, you know, since then.
Yeah. Now, you were a psychologist intern, right, when you say internship?
Yeah. What at the time that I was taking this on, I was a psychological assistant.
Okay.
I mean, I had, you know, in terms of the clinicians working with SI, these were all licensed health and mental health professionals, you know, MDs, PhDs, LCSWs, mm-hmm. mostly. And I was the only one who was pre-licensure.
Okay.
At the time. But, you know, some of that had to do with the fact that I had a lot of prior experience and, a previous graduate psychology work in Germany and so forth.
Okay. Now, I was thinking back to that first case, I would have thought that would be a little scary, kind of daunting. I mean, torture is such a heavy thing to contemplate. Do you recall what your feelings were, you know, in confronting this first client that you knew was, you were going to be seeing, who was a victim of torture?
Well, I mean, what I do recall was just this sense of uncertainty and a bit of fear, I suppose, mm-hmm. you know, about perhaps not knowing enough, or, you know, who am I to get into this at the
exactly.
same time. I also, you know, had some confidence in my abilities generally to, you know, hopefully be smart enough to ask for help if there was something that wasn't going well, and in any case, I had the benefit of supervision at the time, mm-hmm. That was formalized in several ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there were monthly clinical meetings that were held at the office, the headquarters of Survivors International, and so naturally, because I was a new clinician, you know, this was my first case, I then was asked to present the case to the clinical committee, and these were all senior clinicians, mm-hmm. really, you know, and so I had the benefit of being able to discuss it and get everybody's ideas and support, and I knew that, and I think that's one of the things that is really crucial in doing this type of work. I
okay.
mean, really any clinical work, right? Especially with something that is so loaded that you feel like you have contact with colleagues who are encountering similar problems.
Yes. What are the symptoms that you typically see in survivors of torture?
Well, a lot of survivors of torture have really post-traumatic stress disorder, as well as major depressive disorder, mm-hmm. to be really technical for a moment. If you look at it strictly from a medical diagnosis standpoint, very often, much more often than not, those are the two diagnoses that apply at the same time.
Okay.
So people are very depressed, they can't sleep, they have nightmares, they are hypervigilant, you know, people are simply afraid. There's a persistent fear that they experience. And if you think about it, really, what torture is about instilling fear. And it's usually successful in the sense that someone who has experienced torture becomes a fearful person. And this is because torture really is a political instrument.
Mm-hmm.
It's an instrument of oppression, and what it's designed to do is to shut people up, to have them get in line, to lie low, to flee the country, to no longer be a problem to those who are in power.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's
what torture is about, and it works.
Yeah.
It works in the sense that people then have these kinds of problems, usually lifelong. So in some sense, you know, the medical, I just talked about the political, and You know, interpersonally, it really is mostly about the shattering of trust, you can say, mm-hmm. You know.
Yes.
What happens is that people learn at a very deep level that other people cannot be trusted. Because if someone is capable, if a human being is capable of being that sadistic to you over a period of time and putting you through such agony time and time again, that really means that people are bad. And it, of course, generalizes to a certain degree. And so trust is shattered. But, you know, there are many sort of mediating variables, if you will. I mean, there are torture happens in different contexts and in different ways. I've talked about it now a little bit as though it were this monolithic entity, which it isn't at all. Torture can mean a decade of detention in a dungeon and daily specialized methods of inflicting pain and suffering that we typically associate with the word torture. So we have people who experience that type of thing. On the other hand, torture can mean in a context of genocide, your neighbor begins to turn on you and takes your house away from you. Mm-hmm. Somebody forces you, as somebody said to me yesterday, to rape his daughter, and you get locked, herded into a concentration camp and starved, and people, you know, beat you, and it's a very different context, and it's not, you know, solitary confinement. It's not about being a political prisoner. It's about being part of a group of people, and a genocide is being perpetrated. So a lot of people we saw from Bosnia are, you know, went to through those kinds of experiences, whereas other people we see come from these various places around the world where political dissidents get locked up and tortured. And so there's a really wide spectrum of the meaning of what torture is and what people experience.
How do you sit with their stories? I mean, just hearing you allude to some of these things, I find myself taking some deep breaths. I would think it would be hard to sit for you and other clinicians to kind of sit with these painful stories. How do you cope?
It's really a common question, and everybody's question. It's of course a good question, and I'm not sure that it's how possible it is to answer something like this, right? I mean, we are often in so many different ways drawn to things that we usually want to avoid, right? Because mm-hmm. they are painful, mm-hmm. Or they make us feel helpless. And some of, you know, what we as clinicians have in general, I think, is you know, a bit of this sense of trying to do the impossible.
Yes.
You know, Freud talked about the impossible profession, and there is something to that about being stimulated by trying to prevail in for good now, right?
Yes.
I mean, trying to preserve something that is essentially good within ourselves and within relationships. And, you know, that bring healing that we want to insist upon in the face of this adversity or this evil and pain, you know. And so time and again, I think, you know, we're all drawn to doing this sort of thing. And in some ways, it's not so much exactly what we do, but, you know, in technical detail, but more the idea of wanting to do that, communicating to the other that we're there and we're trying, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Much more so that we are trying rather than that we have the answer or anything like that.
Yeah.
And I think that in itself is really a gesture that has a healing built into it in some way.
Mm-hmm. So do you find that, in fact, it makes a difference? Because I heard you say that it leads to lifelong problems.
Yes.
So are both true? It helps, and at the same time, there are maybe residual pieces that just aren't healed?
Yeah, I think that, you know, if you asked a number of different survivors of torture about that, you would get different answers. Because it's very difficult to predict how somebody over the course of a lifetime copes with or heals from this kind of an experience. You know, and you can hear anything from very dark descriptions or experiences of nobody and nothing can change this. You know, this has, you know, marked a person forever, and there is no such thing as trust anymore in the world and other people, and so on. And people commit suicide. Or you can get an experience of having healed and restored meaningful relationships, you know, in terms of going on to having families, finding partners, having children, starting fresh and still feeling pain or having certain symptoms, but being able to gradually build a life nevertheless.
Okay.
And in terms of the symptoms themselves, they tend to the degree that they are chronic, you know, they fluctuate, they ebb and flow. You know, if you put a person under stress, that exacerbates them. You know, if a person is given a peaceful environment in a way to flourish, then they get better. You know, I mean, one of the things that we see all the time is that people, that their symptomatology is exacerbated by the stress they are under in their asylum, political asylum proceedings. Because that creates a lot of stress and fear. What if they deny my asylum claim?
Yes.
And say that I can go back to where I was tortured? You know, to have that hang over your head, that's very, very bad.
Sure.
And right, and so then what we see is that, for instance, if we provide the immigration court with some documentation that supports the person's testimony about what was done to them, then, and they then are successful in their asylum claim, then there is an enormous relief mm-hmm. that occurs, and people feel a lot better, and they get a sense of energy about, I'm looking for a job, a place to live, things are looking up now, and I'm now safe.
Okay.
And it may be that in some cases that then as things stabilize and as they realize that there's still a lot of pain, they may come back for therapy later. You know, I just yesterday had a situation where somebody had gotten political asylum assistance from us several years ago and is now coming back with an explicit request for treatment. You know, that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has these kinds of cycles too that one goes through in life as well.
Yeah. Have you and your colleagues found any therapeutic approaches that seem particularly effective in working with these victims?
My sense has been in talking to other people over all this time that this is like everything else, in the sense that folks who do very different kinds of things clinically in terms of technical methods
mm-hmm.
can have success and or do have success mm-hmm. in making feel better, in alleviating symptoms and so on. And that it doesn't seem to matter so much exactly what the methodology is, as it does whether, first of all, the two people who are working together can work together in some ways. There isn't really a lot of studies out there, right? I mean, you have to do research studies, and those that are out there that I have seen, they are pretty minimal. And in some cases, they don't show any improvement. And, you know, it's a very mixed bag. And what I have found is simply that, you know, amazing things happen clinically with people doing different things. You know, we have some people who work very behaviorally, other people who are very analytic in their approach, and And so that's really all I can tell you. I mean,
well, I remember years ago there was research that showed that outcome studies of therapy that indicated that years of experience were more important than school of thought.
Years of experience.
Yes, the years of experience.
Yeah, you know, but then there were also other studies that showed that years of experience had nothing to do with it, and that, in fact, beginners were as effective as, you know, people with a lot of experience.
Oh,
I think, if I remember correctly.
No, I don't remember that one. I better go back to my textbooks.
I seem to remember that. But see, one of the problems we have, if we are trying to use, you know, statistically based methodology on this type of thing, very often we're not really able to study this well enough, because what we're dealing with is too complex for that kind of an approach.
Yes, yes. Now,
you know, and that's how I've always felt about it. And so I have, to the degree that we do research, I've always trusted process research more than, you know, the traditional outcome study that is more modeled after, you know, medical drug studies and so on.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's just not subject to that kind of study, if you ask me. But that's kind of a theoretical psychology discussion, you
okay.
know, and you know, I may or may not be right about that.
Yeah. Now, what countries are most of your clients coming from these days?
These days, well, let me say first that in any given year, let's say we may take in 120, 150, maybe new clients. And you look at where do they all come from, and it turns out that it's 50 different countries or more.
Oh, really? Okay.
So there are many countries where we have an N of one, so to speak. And over time, it varies quite a bit where people come from, of course, depending on what happens in the world. We still have, for example, a lot of people coming from Central America. We have, you know, Guatemala, El Salvador.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a lot of people coming from various places in Africa, you know, whether it is Kenya, or yesterday I met with somebody from the Sudan. There's always people from the Middle East, North Africa. There is always some people coming from places like Tibet or China, or Sikhs coming from Punjab, India, or not so much anymore now, of course. But so it's very, very diverse. But now also I should add that because for the last couple of years we have expanded our mission to include people who have experienced gender-based persecution, meaning including severe domestic violence against women, and women will flee from places like Mexico to the United States or Central America or very other places, Indonesia or God knows where, right, where they couldn't get away and could get no protection from their husbands, boyfriends, abusers, you know, who would persecute them. And so in that sense, you have to think about it now, too, not just in terms of political oppression, but also in terms of culturally based oppression of women on the one hand and sexual minorities, gays, lesbians, transgender folks who get persecuted for who they are, rather than in terms of what their political or ethnic affiliation may be.
Okay. On your website, I saw that you wrote an editorial that appeared last year in the San Francisco Chronicle, in which you were you were critical of both U.S. government policy and the American Psychological Association. And perhaps you could give us a recap of your concerns.
Well, right now what's happening is that the United States government is using torture increasingly openly and defending the use of torture, although at the same time denying that what is being done is torture, giving it different names by saying that something like waterboarding is an effective interrogation technique and doesn't fit the definition of torture and so on. That, of course, is very, very bad. You know, I mean, in the past we had a situation where the U.S. government, through the School of the Americas, exported torture into different countries clandestinely, so that even though we knew that some of the survivors of torture who came to us essentially had, you know, the marks of the CIA on them, it wasn't at a point where it is now where, see, there's a really important difference between doing things secretly for political purposes, geopolitical purposes, on the one hand, and on the other hand, saying we need to torture people in order to get information from them, right, and to create a whole culture of cruelty, you know, within the military and to advance that kind of an agenda. Mm-hmm. Because what that does is it really messes up the image of the United States as the most important power in the world, that even though it does things wrong periodically, will on the whole enforce human rights standards, right? We have lost that status now. Mm-hmm. And that has a ripple effect throughout the world, so that everybody else can do whatever they want, and nobody can, and the United States is not in a position to say, you know, really what we all have to do and what you have to do is to come to a standard of not torturing people systematically. I'm not sure that's the answer you wanted, but this is where we are now.
Definitely touching on the issues that I was interested in.
Yeah.
And the American Psychological Association developed an ethical position, right, in regard to Guantanamo. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could quickly characterize that.
You know, the position of the American Psychological Association is, from my point of view, not settled at this point, because there are some contradictions. On the one hand, the APA has had clear statements on the books against torture, on the one hand, with specific resolutions, but also, of course, has its general ethical principles. And psychologists are traditionally very clear that they do not condone or use any kind of abuse, much less torture, right? So in some ways you could say that given the code of conduct that psychologists are held to, you wouldn't even have to talk about something like torture, because it is so far beyond what we commit ourselves not to do that it shouldn't be an issue.
Yes.
Right? So then the question arises, why is it that one has to have specific resolutions that make a statement about, you know, we don't participate in something like torture? Well, the reason is that there are psychologists, and there's quite a few of them, who work within the armed forces and other agencies of the government that do, among other things, interrogations. Right, of mm-hmm. enemy combatants of various kinds.
Yes.
So, and then the question becomes, you know, what can the role of a psychologist be when we interrogate in order to get information? So the position that the APA leadership took was from the beginning very strong in the direction of preserving the helping role of psychologists to the military or any other government agency that seeks to obtain information, and that psychologists will do things that are, on the one hand, ethical and, on the other hand, helpful to interrogators in terms of helping them get information out of people, in other words. Right?
Yeah, and you feel there's a conflict of interest there.
Right, right. So, and the other position that the APA could have taken would be to say that, in principle, psychologists should not get involved with interrogating people in context in which, on the face of it, people's human rights are violated, due process is not given, it is not clear, and in general, they should not directly assist in any kind of coercive interrogation technique, whatever exactly is being done. right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
The APA failed to take that position. The other APA, the American Psychiatric Association, did take that position. They took the position that that psychiatrists should not get involved in this kind of interrogation business, period. And because the principle, first do no harm, really dictates that we shouldn't get into that sort of thing.
Yes.
And, you know, it was my feeling, and it's still the feeling of a lot of us who work in this field, that really, in spite of having these strongly worded resolutions against torture and abusive treatment by the APA, what really counts hasn't been addressed.
Yes.
What really counts, and that it's really questionable whether the assertion that psychologists actually will do good if they get involved in these things, because they can prevent abuse, they can prevent what we call behavioral drift, and so forth, which was one of the arguments advanced by Jerry Kuchar. So that's a debate that is still going on at various levels within APA, although my sense is that really the APA leadership at this point would like the debate to be over and say, we have said everything there is to say about it. We don't torture people. We have a very strong worded resolution, and that's really the end of it.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, I've thought that I'd like to do a special show just on this topic alone, and maybe I'll get back to you if you're mm-hmm. interested, because I'd like to have somebody who represents both sides of this debate and have
yes.
a little bit of a discussion between two people.
Yes. Yes, yeah. I mean, there are such discussions were certainly had, and I mean, I had a couple of meetings with Steve Behnke, you know, who's ethics director for the APA, and you know, there were some things that we just disagreed on. You know, for example, you know, he took the position that it would be too difficult to enforce certain things because it would mean that psychologists could say that, well, any kind of involuntary mental health treatment, for example, is a coercive or abusive situation, and so therefore I cannot participate in it, and so on. And I just did not feel that that was really a valid objection. I thought that it was apples and oranges, and that, you know, anybody who really can be clear about these distinctions or wants to be clear about them can be clear about them.
Yes. Well, I hope maybe we can come back to this in a future session. Before we tie things up here, some proportion of our listeners are psychology students, and others may be thinking of midlife career changes in that direction. What was your academic path like?
Oh, my academic path was that I studied psychology at the University of Tübingen for several years in Germany, and I had a bit of a double life because I was outside of university very interested and pursued all kinds of depth psychology, you know, everything between psychoanalysis and bioenergetics and primal therapy and so forth,
uh-huh.
and got involved in all kinds of different things experientially, and was really much more interested in all kinds of depth psychology. But at the university, you know, of course, had to study very mainstream academic psychology, and so I got a kind of very mixed education mm-hmm. and experience from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And then I came to the United States on a scholarship and went to Antioch West in San Francisco, which had a program of somatic psychology, and completed that program. And
was that for a bachelor's degree or a master's
no,
degree?
That was for a master's in clinical psychology,
oh, okay.
is what I got there from Antioch University. And that program now is at CIIS. It moved around a bit, and, you know, that and it's...
For my listeners, CIIS is California Institute of Integral Studies in San Francisco.
Yes, and it's a very interesting program, and it's really built on the premise that learning should be primarily experiential and it should be embodied, and so it's very powerful. I really liked going through that. And then after I was done there, I went to the Wright Institute in Berkeley, and that's where I got my PhD degree. And so I had 3 graduate psychology courses in a row, essentially, and they were all very different, all 3 of them.
Hey, well, I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, you're welcome.
And hopefully I'll have you back again.
Thanks a lot.
I hope you found this interview instructive. I certainly applaud my guest, Dr. Uwe Jacobs, and his staff for both their courage and their compassion in being willing to tackle such frightening and heart-rending issues as arise from torture. As I mentioned in the interview, I would think it hard to sit with the terrible stories of pain and suffering that these therapists who work with the victims of torture must hear. Of course, therapists are generally trained to keep sufficient distance from their clients' problems so as not to take them on. However, it may be that some kinds of problems are of such a magnitude that they would challenge a therapist's defenses more than others. In fact, I found some support for this point of view in the literature. I found a 2003 article in the APA journal, Professional Psychology, Research and Practice. The article was titled Therapists' Reactions to Treatment of Survivors of Political Torture. According to this article's abstract, and I quote, working with survivors of political torture and war trauma can trigger strong emotional responses in the therapist. As more survivors seek treatment, it's essential to identify and develop robust support systems for therapists who help their clients confront nearly unspeakable experiences. The emotional reactions of 6 psychotherapists who work with traumatized survivors in a refugee treatment center were explored. The psychotherapist's reactions were compared with those of therapists who worked in different treatment settings with other presenting problems. The results of the study show that the strong level of responsibility therapists feel for their traumatized clients may hide an emotional strain and may lead to burnout. Suggestions are offered for supporting therapists in this difficult but important work. End quote. Now, the authors are quick to admit that 6 is a very small sample, and they explore a lot of the sort of pluses and minuses of their approach. Despite this, however, their findings do make sense on the face of it. These Swedish authors, as stated above, compared 6 Swedish therapists working with torture victims against 6 other therapists working with non-torture populations. And their findings suggest that the therapists working with torture victims suffer a variety of negative consequences over time. For example, they write, quote, however, the therapists change from feeling overwhelmed and surprised initially to feeling more bored and indifferent. Feelings of engagement and empathy decline, and feelings of boredom increase. This development suggests the risk of burnout. And then they refer to another study by McCann and Perlman, 1990, suggested a number of causes of trauma therapists' burnout. These reasons include lack of treatment success, clients' reluctance to talk about the traumatic memories, and hopelessness about the root causes of human evil. End quote. A bit further on in this article, they say, if therapists, and I quote again, if therapists are to function as competent and effective treatment providers, they need to retain their openness and sensitivity to different variants of affective reactions. Attentive relaxation, engaged interest, and honest awareness of the variants of negative feelings must be available to them. Considering the current interest in relational aspects of psychotherapy and the potential usefulness of countertransference reactions, the therapist's knowledge about the sources of his or her emotional reactions is important. Psychotherapeutic work with survivors of political torture evokes feelings that therapists do not experience in other types of work, such as work with clients who have lifelong psychiatric pathology. Therapists who start questioning whether their neighbors could become enemies and force them into concentration camps have special kinds of issues to deal with that are not present with other clients. They go on to say, this study confirmed results from previous reports about typical feelings experienced by therapists who work with traumatized clients. Although all therapists had long, sustained experience with psychotherapy, the contact with a traumatized client evoked complicated and troubled feelings. All the traumatized clients brought their unique stories of suffering and degradation. No therapist can be prepared for what his or her clients will share during therapy. Therapists cannot rely on habitual methods of relating to these clients. Instead, they must be prepared to endure unusual expectations and reactions from them, end quote. And a bit further on, they say, psychotherapeutic work with traumatized refugees has unique and special societal qualities. Compared with work with normal psychiatric clients and even clients of such traumas as sexual assaults or physical catastrophes, work with victims of political torture forces the therapist to confront complicated moral and political situations. Current international conflicts demonstrate how difficult political, social, economic, and religious controversies may escalate and induce human beings to lose their compassion and humanity. These dramatic and often incomprehensible conflicts enter into the therapy room when the refugee conveys stories about torture and humiliation. As one therapist said, it is the evil that hits you. It comes right into the treatment room. Finally, in their summary, the authors conclude, this study has shown that psychotherapists who work with traumatized clients have reactions that are significantly different from those of other therapists who do not work with survivors of political torture. Although we cannot say that trauma therapists copied symptoms in the manner that vicarious traumatization in its narrow sense implies, the combination of increased distance to the clients, indication of burnout reactions, and sometimes strong physical reactions identifies several needs. Trauma therapists need to be vigilant about their feelings, examine them without bias, and try to learn about their causes. The deep sense of commitment and wish to help suffering persons may hide great emotional strain. Professional supervision and training in cultural competence are strongly recommended in order to handle the lack of a relaxed therapeutic stance, which therapy with traumatized persons inherently implies. End quote. I discovered that there is a relatively large and growing literature having to do with psychotherapy among the victims of torture, and the article I reviewed here represents only one point of view. From my conversation with Dr. Jacobs, I have the impression that there may be a couple of factors at work that would help to mitigate the dangers of therapist burnout in his particular setting of Survivors International. First, I have the impression that there's frequent supervision and case conferencing, opportunities for therapists to get input and emotional support from their peers would help to diminish the likelihood of burnout. Beyond this, I have the impression that most of these Survivors International mental health professionals are working with torture victims as only a small part of their overall clinical practice. Those who have endured the most pain are also the most deserving of our listening and our caring. And at the same time, the professionals who are involved in this work must be careful to be taking good care of themselves as well, lest they suffer from what the literature calls secondary traumatization.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Again, I want to thank each of you who has taken our listener survey. Right now, we have 41 completed surveys, which include a lot of valuable feedback and suggestions. At the very end of the survey, you have the option to include your name and email address. Everyone who completes the survey and submits their email address will automatically be emailed back with a link to a radio talk I gave on dreams before a live audience at the University of New Hampshire. You find the survey at shrinkwrapradio.com/survey.htm, or you can also find a link on our website. As all you psych majors probably know, we need to get at least 100 completed surveys back before they become statistically meaningful. So if you're listening in your car or on a walk, please remember to do it first thing when you get back home. It only takes a few minutes. Meanwhile, we have 3 new pins in our Frapper map, and I want to give a big thank you and a welcome to Andy in Bamberg, Bavaria, Germany, Jeremy in Tracy, California, and Greg in Bryson City, North Carolina. To add yourself to our growing Frapper map, all you need to do is go to frapper.com/shrinkwrapradio, or you'll find a link on our website at shrinkwrapradio.com. Plus, you'll be entered into a drawing for a free copy of a book that I co-authored. By the way, in my unending quest for shrink wrap radio world domination, I really like to see new countries added to the Frapper map. Using a site called feedburner.com, I'm able to see where the downloads are coming from, and I've seen that there are people downloading shrink wrap radio from countries in Asia and South America that haven't placed a pin on the map. So come on, all you international people, and plant your flag. Now, as you may know, we're part of the Podshow network, and you can subscribe to this show by going to podshow.com. Even if you don't decide to subscribe there, you might be interested in going to the site, which is being substantially upgraded this week. I received the following email from them, which reads as follows. On behalf of the entire Podshow organization, I'm extremely proud to share the following news with you. Next week, Podshow Plus is being unleashed with a redesigned media experience for you and your audience that is aimed at getting your content on the screens and in the ears of as many fans and people as possible, as quickly and easy as possible, all while maintaining a cool, cutting-edge vibe. The augmented and newly introduced features will include new Podshow Plus homepage that delivers tighter integration of music, shows, video, and music channels, master control that lets users navigate through all of their uploads and content from one database with easy management of images, profile information, favorite shows, videos, collections, and more. Video network that highlights the best video content Podshow Plus has to offer, and videos from all over the world, all in one easy-to-navigate video network site. The music guide will act as the guide to the best in independent and mainstream artists. And that's how the email ends. So be sure to check out the new Podshow Plus at www.podshow.com. And speaking of websites, don't forget you can get great discounts on a whole range of web services at GoDaddy.com by using either Shrink1, Shrink2, or Shrink3 at checkout. You can find more information about this on our website.
Yeah, you should really listen to that Dr. Dave show. A lot of people are tuning in. It's extremely popular. I've met Dr. Dave a couple times and listened to his show and liked it very much. There's a lot of good stuff there. And for those of you who are into what your mind is doing, it's an interesting little piece of your body. What's going on in your head? You might want to check it out, Shrink Wrap Radio, shrinkwrapradio.com.
Thank you for that endorsement, Adam Curry, podfather and founder of Podshow. Now let's go on to some listener emails. The first reads, "Hi, Dr. Dave, just a quick note from the UK. I'm a new listener, stumbled across your podcasts on Podcast Pickle. Love the format, easy listening yet informative. I'm a lecturer in ICT and accelerated learning at a college in Yorkshire in UK, and the content in your shows links directly to what I'm trying to achieve here, improving learning for disaffected learners through teaching them directly and working with their teachers. My background is software programming, not psychology, so your shows are giving me the chance to investigate how the mind works. Keep up the excellent work. Thanks for your help, Richard. And he's at Calderdale College, Halifax, West Yorkshire in the UK. How great to get those words of encouragement. Next, we hear from Mike, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. First of all, I love the podcast. I'm a grad student in psychology at the University of Western Ontario. On my lazier days, I can go for a walk with your podcast playing and convince myself that I'm doing work for school. Of course, to some extent, it's pretty much sort of like studying." I'm so glad to hear that I've got grad student psychology listeners as one of my intended target audiences. He goes on to write, "The main point of my email is to commend you for having the balls to discuss controversial topics on the show, parapsychology in particular. I realize that the mere mention of parapsychology can often elicit disrespect from less open-minded scientists. Hopefully, hearing eloquent, level-headed guests like Charles Tart and Stanley Krippner on your show can start to change their minds a bit. It seems to me that if there is even a small chance that phenomena such as precognition exist, then they deserve extensive research. Parapsychologists have shown that it's possible to study these phenomena scientifically, and that even the most carefully controlled experiments do indeed find there is more than a small chance that they exist. Even if it is not really precognition that can explain the results of these experiments, something interesting is still going on. Using the methods of science, researchers are finding something that looks a lot like precognition. Either there is something wrong with the methods, or something like precognition is actually occurring. Either explanation is fascinating to me anyway. I actually attended a summer study program at the Ryan Research Center in Durham, North Carolina. I had the pleasure of meeting a large percentage of the scientists involved in the small field of parapsychology, including Dr. Krippner, which was a great honor. While I'm still not 100% convinced that things like ESP and PK exist, by the way, PK stands for psychokinesis, the ability to move things with your mind. Okay, back to the letter. He says, while I'm still not 100% convinced that things like ESP and PK exist, I do know one thing. Evidence for these things is not due to irresponsible or sloppy researchers, nor to a couple of nut jobs fabricating research to support a pre-specified agenda. Rather, these people are true scientists fascinated by the unknown with a drive to explore it. This seems to apply to you, too, and to many of the guests on your show. So, to conclude, thank you so much for the podcast. I look forward to future shows on subjects both conventional and controversial. P.S. I second the request from one of the reader emails in your last show. An interview about where fiction writers get their ideas would be a great topic. I'd never heard of Jonathan Kellerman, but your mention has inspired me to look him up, so thanks again for that reference." And that's from Mike. And Mike, I thank you very much for that email, and of course agree with you entirely in your observations about the integrity of that handful of brave souls who are the parapsychological researchers these days. Our next listener email is from Christine, and she writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I would very much like to have the art therapy bibliography you mentioned. I'm currently a psychology major with an emphasis in art therapy and a minor in anthropology at Arcadia University. While I haven't had the time to listen to all your episodes yet, the ones I have listened to have given me a lot to think about. Thank you, Christine." I hadn't heard of Arcadia University. I went on the web, and I think it's located in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is cool since that's the city where I got my bachelor's degree at the University of Pennsylvania. And so I have sent that bibliography off to Christine, and I'll be happy to send it out to any other listeners that might want a copy as well. Just drop me a line. Our next email actually comes in the form of a MyChingo voice message.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I'm here, Susie, in Vancouver, and I absolutely love your podcast. I find it has an excellent balance of psychology, but just enough science that it makes it really enjoyable. I've been reading more and more into Carl Jung and his theories, and I believe one topic that I think would be really interesting that almost everyone can relate to is gossip. And I find it's a quality that I really don't like in others, but I'm starting to realize that perhaps it's just part of my shadow and that I myself am quite manipulative and I am a sneaky gossiper and I can get people to gossip before they even know they are, but I don't like it. And so I was thinking maybe this would be an excellent topic for you to discuss and help me with dealing with this part of my personality that I don't like. Thank you, and good night.
Susie, what a great topic for discussion you've brought up. Well, it sounds to me like you've taken an excellent first step, which is to recognize that your judgments against those who gossip might actually be a projection of your own shadow. Good for you. It takes courage to stand back from ourselves and to realize that we have to own qualities that we find distasteful in others. And since you ask for my advice, I'll go ahead and give it. It occurs to me that a good second step might be for you to engage in a bit more self-analysis and ask yourself, what up until now unconscious purpose does gossiping serve for you? What do you get out of it? How might it be part of some earlier, perhaps primitive, survival strategy that maybe served you at one time but no longer serves you? Try closing your eyes and put this question to yourself and see what, if anything, pops up. I think it's important for you to understand what need gossiping has filled for you. Maybe there are other, better ways to meet that need, or maybe that need is no longer as significant in your life as it once was. Maybe you've outgrown it. Assuming you want to stop gossiping, the third step is to become even more aware of it so that you can stop it. Many times we will unconsciously repeat undesirable behaviors so automatically that we're unaware of doing so. So you can practice becoming more mindful in this regard. If you're really brave, you can even enlist the help of your friends by saying something along the lines of, "I've recently been aware that I sometimes have a tendency to gossip about other people. I don't admire that quality in myself, and I want to stop it. I'd appreciate it if you would help me stop by pointing it out if I ever start to do it with you. Would you be willing to do that?" Now, Susie, your question about gossip actually got me to wondering what academic psychology might have to say on the subject. I did a bit of a literature search and discovered that there has been a fair amount of social psychological research on the topic. I turned up some interesting articles. In fact, in June of 2004, the Review of General Psychology published an entire issue on gossip. All the articles in this special issue argue that gossip is purposeful and important to social functioning. Without going into an extensive review here, I can tell you that even though there can be negative consequences from gossip, some investigators find that gossip also plays some important positive roles in maintaining social cohesion and maintaining the social pecking order. To give you the flavor of this line of research, let me read from the abstract of an article by R.I. Dunbar. Quotes, "Conversation is a uniquely human phenomenon. Analyses of freely forming conversations indicate that approximately two-thirds of conversation time is devoted to social topics, most of which can be given the generic label gossip. This article explores the origins of gossip as a mechanism for bonding social groups, tracing these origins back to social grooming among primates. It then asks, why social gossip in this sense should form so important a component of human interaction and presents evidence to suggest that aside from servicing social networks, a key function may be related explicitly to controlling free riders." I'm not sure what free riders refers to. Finally, the author reviews briefly the role of social cognition in facilitating conversations of this kind. And so this article goes on, and the others do too, in a similar vein. Susie, I was hoping I'd find your email address among the listener surveys that have been submitted so far. I didn't find it there, but if you'll fill out the survey, or even just send me your email address, I'd be happy to send you copies of 5 or 6 of the articles I turned up on gossip. Or I'm sure you can find them on your own in your local university library. It may be that after reading the research on the positive functions of gossip, you'll decide to keep at it. Or not. I'd appreciate an update at any rate. And I think that better wrap it up for our email for today. Once again, please help us to grow our audience by spreading the word about Shrink Wrap Radio. And you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Leave your voicemails on Skype, where our name is ShrinkPod. And you can also leave voice messages, just like Susie did, on MyChingo, which you'll find a link to on our Shrink Wrap Radio website. Thanks again to our guest, Dr. Uwe Jacobs, for the interview. And I want to let you know that my next guest will be Dr. Lee Jampolsky, former student of mine and author of 5 or 6 very inspiring books. I think you'll enjoy meeting Lee. We close with a piece of PodSafe music, which I think is my favorite. I've played it a number of times before, and it seems an appropriate follow-on to our discussion of torture. It's called Peace in the Spirit of John Lennon by Brad Stanfield. You'll find a link to this tune in our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
Everyone lives, everyone dies. Everyone loves, everyone cries. Round the world, we're all alike. So why is there war? Why do we fight? There's one sea, one sky, one earth, so you and I gotta learn to live together. When one hurts, when one needs, we all feel, we all bleed. Gotta learn to live together. Time, brother, stop dying. Isn't it time, mother, stop crying? Stop the fighting and the hate. We gotta make peace before it's too late. There's one sea, one sky, one earth, so you and I gotta learn to live together. Alright, when one hurts, when one needs, we all feel, we all bleed. Gotta learn to live.